Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1998, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a conductor. He went to school in Coventry and became a choir boy at the cathedral there, enjoying the everyday life of the musically gifted. He read music, of course, at Cambridge, and then joined the staff of the English National Opera, where he learned his trade. But it was at Opera North in the early 90s that he came into his own. Only 31, he galvanised the musical direction of the company, making it daring and exciting. Then, last year, he took over as music director of the English National Opera. Within weeks of his arrival, his boss had resigned, and there was talk of merging with Covent Garden. The war for ENO survival has since been won. It's my castaway's job now to help win the peace. Happily, he's an optimist. I believe it's worth dreaming, he says, and often you get half of what you dream. He is Paul Daniel. So what you dream of, Paul, is presumably, you know, what's anybody who runs a big theatre in which you put on entertainment, which is that you want to have full houses and you want critical acclaim and you want license to put on more of what you believe should be on your stage. What kind of thing is that in your case?
It's all kinds of work that challenge an audience, challenge that traditional audience that has come because their fathers and their grandfathers came, but also challenge people to think of the act of performance as something very fresh.
So it's more contemporary than traditional, is it? It's more Birtwistle than Beethoven?
No, not necessarily. I think all art is contemporary because Verdi never thought of his piece as something that actually was in a museum. It was there to be revived, revised, put on change so that it became a fresh piece of work for the audience, and he changed his mind about the piece because he knew the audience that would be watching it.
But a lot of the audience don't like traditional things set in modern dress and so on, do they? That's your problem.
That's not my problem. It's probably their problem.
But it's obviously clear that you stand for a kind of breaking of the rules, isn't it? I mean, when you conducted your first opera as music director at the ENO last autumn, The Flying Dutchman, you don't wear the tails, you wear the casual jacket, collarless shirt, you get up on the stage at the end, pull out a member of the chorus to take the applause with you. That's all very important to you, isn't it? Just saying, let's get rid of the rules, let's let everybody share the laurels here.
I'm not interested in wearing tails particularly because tails, once upon a time, used to be the common currency between the audience and the performers. Everybody wore tails. It was just what you wore in the evening. Nowadays, it actually is there to say, we're special. We're something different from you and the audience out there. I don't like that. I'm not interested in that. Actually, the Colosseum's an incredibly hot place, so it's actually quite good not to wear big, heavy clothes.
But were you nervous last autumn, first time as music director of the ENO?
I was very aware of the responsibility. It is a very big theatre, it's a very big company, it has a very, very big reputation. I wasn't there to suddenly make it daring and challenging. That company stands on the fact that it dared to challenge accepted ways. Lillian Bayliss came along in the 30s and said, no, we don't want that elitist stuff that's not understood by more than half the audience. We want to perform directly to these people, just like Verdi wanted us to perform, or Mozart. You know, they all completely happily changed the language of their operas so that the audience would be immediately in contact with what was being performed. She said, that's what we're going to do.
Hmm. But it doesn't stop you feeling terrified, presumably, as you walk out there. Even though, I mean, you so want to make contact with that audience. You so want to, you know, bring this company onto the stage and give it all you've got.
I am not terrified. I am never terrified of the audience. I am very, very nervous of the responsibility of doing the repertoire, the actually bringing these pieces to life. But, no, I love performing.
Music for your desert island. Tell me about it in the first one.
I thought very hard about what it would be like to be alone on a desert island. And I thought it would be unbearable to listen to opera. Opera is a very big, communal social event. It needs a big, big audience to respond to a very big artistic statement. I think stuck on your own, trying to join in with what you're hearing on a recording, I don't think I could possibly listen to any of that. There's no opera.
So, what have you got? What's the first one?
My first piece takes me back to being a cathedral choir boy. It takes me back to a very special man called David Lapine, who ran the choir in Coventry. I joined in only 3 or 4 years after the cathedral had been opened again, after the rebuilding, after the war. In 1966 I began. He had a mission. He didn't like traditional cathedral choirs. He didn't like quite a lot of traditional cathedral music. He wanted a sound which was modern, not hooty, quite focused, and it was a fantastic introduction to the musical world for me.
Welcome, Yol, from Britain's Ceremony of Carols, sung by the Coventry Cathedral Boys Choir, directed by David Lapine, and that was recorded in Coventry Cathedral in 1971. And somewhere on that album, there's Paul Daniel, the boy soloist, I think, isn't there?
On one track that I wouldn't like to listen to too many times.
What is fascinating, I think, reading about you, is that you had this natural musical ability, but it wasn't in the family at all. Nobody, there's no known gene in the Daniel family for music, is that right?
It's fairly sketchy. My mother certainly would have done more music if she'd had the opportunity. And my father loves music, but he wasn't a practicing musician either. It wasn't part of what you could do.
But they report that young Paul, aged 7 or something, waved around this thing he called a magic stick and conducted the sound of music. How did you know? I mean, well, what was it that opened the door to music for you?
Well, it's something that's gone now, and it was the fact that at a state infant school, you were given a proper musical start. It's got to come back. Orchestras report now that there are far fewer young musicians coming forward properly trained right from the beginning so that they can play or think about music in the way that they speak English. And that happened to me.
In what way? Did you hear the piano or you heard
an somebody put a recorder in my hand and said, play this. My daughters go to a private school. I'm very happy to say that they have a wonderful education, but it is an elitist education because an awful lot of children in London are not being given the musical chances that my daughters have been given. They may not become musicians, but at least they're being exposed, just like you're being exposed to the language you speak or the things that happen around you, scientifically, geographic, whatever. It's a normal part of most societies. It has ceased to become one of ours. And thanks to Simon Rattle, thanks to the people who've been making a big noise about it in the last few years, I think that the government is beginning to realise that it is just as important to develop your soul as it is to develop your ability to count.
Tell me about your second record.
This is my wife, Joan, performing one of those wonderful, perfect songs by Rachmaninoff. I think I discovered that she sang this song in the first week that I'd met her, and it kind of helped to seal a rather special relationship.
Rachmaninoff's song How Peaceful, sung by my castaway's wife Joan Rogers, accompanied by Howard Shelley. So, Paul Daniel, you were simply soaked from dawn to dusk in Coventry in music, choir practice, rehearsals. You did at least two instruments, I think piano and oboe, is that right? Performances, rehearsing all of it. It's a bit like training to be a musical athlete, really, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose we were all little Olga Corbetts, actually. We started before school. We spent the whole weekend. I never played, mucked around, because it was so much focus in my life, you know, achieving what we had to achieve musically.
So you didn't mind not playing football or whatever it was? Because this was the 60s, wasn't it?
I didn't mind at all. I mind very much now that I missed that out, because I think the ability to play is something that is very important. And maybe that's why I like opera so much, because actually it's my long-lost childhood coming through. I get to muck around and, you know, you turn up in rehearsals and you experiment with human emotions on a big scale, you know, all day long. It's like making sure that you're still in touch with your childhood.
But the training was superb for what you do now, because now you're rehearsing something while you're performing something else and so on. It takes all of that juggling and all of that athletic ability, doesn't it, to keep at the job and
keep
all the
balls
in the air.
I'm a sucker for punishment. You know, I think there's a purity of line that you can get from just devoting yourself to, you know, and doing less work to make sure you get the actual finished project so polished that it's perfect. I'm not sure that I would get any closer to the things that I do if I isolated myself more. I think I do need the cut and thrust of being in a company and playing one aspect of the work off against another, one opera off against another, one part of the company's work off against another. It's that sense of a big community of people working, pushing together is important.
But you're a perfectionist and you like to be in control.
I think a lot of people are perfectionists where I work, and
this is a very diplomatic answer, but you do like to be in control, don't you? You like it to be done like you want it done.
Yes. The people look to you from time to time, actually an awful lot of times, to actually decide how it will be. People are always asking about what happens when you conduct, how do you do it, you know, what happens, what do they follow the beat in any one bar of music? You're deciding one thing within half a second. You're playing the role of listener, working out what's coming back at you. Within the next half second, you're deciding to encourage something that people hadn't really thought about, but you're not actually pushing. It's so subtle the way it works, the way an orchestra and a chorus and a group of people make music together.
But if somebody who knew a lot about music sat in the stalls and with their eyes closed, would they know it was you conducting, or could they identify different conductors? They could, couldn't they? You have a style that comes through no matter how spontaneous and creative you feel you're being in the moment.
I think no matter how much I struggle to be one thing or another, you know, you keep reading or hearing the same kinds of descriptions.
What are the adjectives used about you?
The worst word probably is analytical. The best description that I like to read is that actually somehow a lot of the detail in the music has been exposed or comes through, that there is a kind of cleaning up of the music. The downside is that I'm not very good at being sentimental.
Record number three.
This is me from the age of 8 or even 7, every Good Friday, performing the St. Matthew Passion in Coventry Cathedral every year. First year, in awe of what's going on, extremely bored with the fact that you have to sit there for hours and hours. And by the 6th year or 7th year, I'm singing it from memory. The beginning of the piece, every time I hear it, with this throbbing bass and this very long phrase unfolding, takes me straight back to that moment when I know that I'm going to perform the whole of this piece.
the opening of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, performed by the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque Soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardner. You went up to Cambridge, Paul, where you were very serious about your piano studies. Apparently your performances of the Beethoven concertos are remembered with awe, they tell me. Did you consider becoming a pianist?
No.
So when did you decide you were going to be a conductor?
I'd known I wanted to be a conductor for some absurd, self-deluded reason, for years and years. I think right back to when I first saw concerts actually in Coventry Cathedral, because many great orchestras from the Berlin Philharmonic down or across came well, to...
When
came
you
to
were, what, 8, 9, 10 years old?
Yeah, 9 and 10.
You thought, I want to be that guy up the front with the stick.
Yeah, and it wasn't to do with megalomania. I promise you, I just felt... I just thought that something about what he had to do, the musicians that he got to work with, was worth its weight in gold.
So when did you get your big break? Because everybody who makes it to the top in their chosen profession has one. Who was it? What was it? What happened?
I got to work as a repetiteur. It's not a big break particularly. It's a kind of traditional way in for a conductor in Europe to work in an opera company. You get to play the piano. You coach the singers. You get to conduct the trumpets off stage. You get to conduct the chorus. You get to conduct a rehearsal when the real conductor doesn't turn up. You get to finally maybe conduct a few tail-end performances, and then you get to one day conduct the big one. I was conducting Fidelio on 7 hours' notice one Saturday when the conductor was suddenly ill and the cover had been too busy doing something else. I'd been playing the piano for rehearsals rather badly, and suddenly I was conducting the real thing.
How was it?
A complete joy, I have to say. I was terrified, and I remember starting... I'd never conducted the orchestra in the pit, in the Colosseum. Fidelio starts with a very brisk two bars and then a pause, and I conducted these first two bars. I didn't know what was going to happen, and it happened, and they played, and they're fantastic. And I got to the pause, and in those 5 seconds at the beginning, I thought, ah, I'm going to enjoy this.
And were you wearing tails?
Yes, I was.
Record number 4.
This is the Daniel family in Yorkshire. Our daughters, Eleanor and Rose, growing up in the most wonderful house. We kind of landed in paradise when we went to Opera North. We were asked if we'd like to live in this fantastic, beautiful manor house, come stately home, sitting on the top of a hill, looking out over Wharfdale. And we danced. I remember we sometimes to keep warm, probably. So this is all of us bashing around the kitchen.
Bob Marley and the Wailers and Is This Love. You went, Paul, off to become music director at the Opera Factory next, an outfit noted for its avant-garde productions. That's when you really let it rip, isn't it, with this kind of rock version of the Beggar's Opera and Harrison Birtwistle's Punch and Judy. You were really at the kind of cutting edge, having fun.
We knew we were doing something that was a bit shocking. And, yes, we were challenging people. And we were deliberately doing it in an aggressive way.
And so when you were appointed at Opera North, you already had this reputation for putting on pieces perhaps that other people wouldn't dare. I mean, is that why you were booked, do you feel?
Opera North was a very young company. David Lloyd-Jones had set it up in 1978. It already had a reputation for being pioneering.
But
an area of the country.
Had they ever done anything as daring as to go to Munich and get on stage and say, we won the war 1-0, and F off Hitler, and whatever else you said in Munich?
Yeah, that was a very special moment. That's a tribute to a great company. The chorus of that company had to get on stage, as you say, and come on right at the beginning of this piece, in the hotbed of Nazi German, if you like, from the past, and deliver these lines. It was an opera about an English team playing Bayern München in a cup final. And it was a kind of Faustian piece, a brilliant piece of work, Howard Brenton and Ben Mason. They came on, they must have been terrified. And the audience went wild when they heard this, and it was one of the great...
Horror or pleasure?
Pleasure. Delight that someone actually dared to make fun, in the best sense of theatre, of something that had been... I'd become a taboo.
But so there we are again, breaking the rules. And in a sense, you could say that you've built your reputation on that kind of contemporary 20th century music. And you managed to pull the audience in at Opera North to see that kind of thing. How do you explain that? One almost feels perhaps they're broader minded than a metropolitan audience, that they'd adopted you. And so they came to see it.
The audience for Opera North was a very precise audience, and it owned that opera company. It knew that if it wasn't there, the company wouldn't be there. Metropolitan audiences have many, many choices to make every night of the week in London, for example. They've got any number of things they could go to, similar kinds of things. They're not jaded, but they are...
spoiled.
Yeah.
Record number five.
This is part of an opera that Harry Birtwistle wrote for Covent Garden, one of the great projects that Covent Garden pulled off, Gawain. He, together with Gary Howarth, invented a suite from the opera for the Orchestra of Opera North to play in Huddersfield. And I was very lucky to conduct it. It's a very, very special piece. It's taken from the opera. And we gave the first performance in the Huddersfield Contemporary Music Festival.
The Philharmonia Orchestra playing the opening of The Journey from Harrison Birtwistle's suite Gawain's Journey, conducted by Elgar Howarth. To use your own analogy, Paul Daniel, Opera North is a frigate to E&O's oil tanker. You're said to have refused the job, turned it down as music director of the E&O at least twice, if not more often. Why? Were you frightened of it?
That sounds a very grand thing to do. No, I was very committed to what I was doing at Opera North, and I had been there, I think, about 5 years when English National Opera needed a music director. It seemed inconceivable to me that I should just pack up and leave. We were doing some great things at Opera North. That company has such energy.
Yes, but to be offered one of the busiest, if not the busiest, opera house in the world to come and run, I mean, not enjoying huge critical acclaim at the time, in a bit of a parlous financial state, but... Nevertheless, an enormous challenge. Why weren't you tempted?
Well, I'm only a conductor, and I suppose I'm only an artist. I just knew that what we were doing at Opera North was worth doing, and I just wanted to do more of it.
But finally, you did. Not that the relationship was over, but the time seemed better, yes?
Lord Harwood broke the knot. He said to me, "Look, you're absolutely right, but think ahead another year. Let them wait an extra year. And then consider it again."
And then, as I mentioned, within weeks of your arrival, Dennis Marks, the general director, had resigned, which left you effectively, I think, in day-to-day charge of the place. And Chris Smith, the Secretary of State, was suggesting that the E&O could move in with the Royal Opera at Covent Garden. You must have felt as if the world had gone mad. It had just shifted underneath you completely.
Yes, but it made everybody feel very good.
Siege mentality moved in, did it?
Yeah. Other companies might have gone mute or silent or run for cover. That's not the spirit of English National Opera. And what I did came completely naturally to me. On the night of Chris Smith's proposal, I I'd been conducting From the House of the Dead, a new production of the Janáček opera, and I just decided on the spur of the moment at the end of the performance to say something, and it's kind of become famous or infamous that we did this, you know, that I made a lot of speeches to our audience.
Asked them to write to the Secretary of State.
Yeah, it just seemed natural to me. They were the people who had the most to say about it, actually, the audience, and that it was one of the best times for the company.
And as I said, you know, you won that war in the end. The threat of merger has gone away. And more than that, I mean, one doesn't want to encourage you to indulge in schadenfreude, but the Royal Opera House is going to be dark all next year. Perhaps you should put on a well-known opera like Traviata in the original language, just to prove that you can do it too.
Yes, I think that would kill any sense of what our audience expected of us.
But you might get in the audiences. Other audience who does like it, the audience that goes to the Opera House.
Yeah, they can listen to their CDs.
Record number 6.
This is our family deciding at about a few hours' notice to dash off to the Loire for a weekend, just a while ago, very recently. And I bought this tape in a duty-free in New Haven. And the children... Well, we all became children. It is the most absurd piece of comedy and most surreal alternative thing that I've ever heard.
A little Red Riding Hood met a naughty old wolf in a wood. I'm going to see Grandmama, she said, for poor old Granny's ill in bed. But when she reached the house, it was as quiet as a mouse. It was quieter.
But the wolf sat there in Grandma's place with a nightcap round his horrible face.
Hermione Gingold and Gilbert Harding with Oh Grandma. We were talking earlier on about your desperate desire not to be elitist, which is what's come through in everything you've said. But how do you do it? How? You know, tell me simply and straightforwardly, how do you get people over the doorstep of an opera house who wouldn't normally walk over it?
We perform a lot and work a lot with people who never come anywhere near the Colosseum. And we do more and more of that as the years go by.
In schools and things, yeah. And workshops.
People
and
who don't need to be queuing up in St Martin's Lane. They need it in their own communities. We are a very large company and we have a lot of talent.
So what happens when you go out to a school of young lads in the East End and an opera singer stands up and, you know, sings a wonderful aria?
Well, that's the point. That's not how we do it anymore. It used to be the case that we say, here we are, and this is very grand, and it's very beautiful, and it's very good for you, and listen to this, here is a very famous singer. Yes, it's very loud, and there's a wobbly voice, and they don't quite know what it's about. Actually, now you go there, you say, this is an issue, here's a subject, here's an idea. What would you do if you were creating this piece?
Mm. But that requires them to be active, and I think that you require your audience in the stalls in the Colosseum to be active. You don't want a passive audience. You are saying to them, come here, listen to this, see if you like it, try this on for size, come with me. Go on, honestly, put up with it, because I think if you can come through, you'll like it in the end. Audiences don't want to pay to have to work that hard.
I don't think they have to work that hard in a negative sense. I think they have to work very hard in a positive sense. We, as a nation, are very bad at opening our emotions up, and that's why opera exists. It exists to deal with all the taboos in society. That's true of a passionate nation like the Italians or a kind of locked-in nation like the British. In a way... That's why opera is even more important for one of these kind of cold, frozen northern nations like Britain.
Seventh record.
This is a very great orchestra. I can say that because I don't conduct it anymore as its music director, but it is the Orchestra of Opera North, the English Northern Philharmonia, which has a very separate career also as a symphony orchestra, doing a lot of work. It had the great good fortune to be set up in Leeds, where there was no local symphony orchestra. Most other opera companies exist in cities where there are very, very good symphony orchestras. Yeah, it's me conducting, I'm afraid, but it is a tribute to their fantastic virtuosity.
English Northern Philharmonia performing part of the last movement of Walton's Symphony No. 1 in B-flat minor, conducted by my castaway, Paul Daniel. So it's off to a desert island with you, Paul. All that creative energy and nowhere to direct it. What will happen to you?
I used to think it would be rather wonderful to get away. And actually, when I do get away to guest conduct elsewhere, it can be a very fulfilling experience, but then it's only for a finite period. I think it would be terrifying. I am very frightened of the idea of being alone with nobody to communicate with.
Frightened of losing touch with reality, perhaps?
Well, I'm a performer, and the idea of not being able to share performances or be performed to would be very frightening, I think.
Tell me about your last record.
Well, this connects back with something that... It's a piece that I know from my childhood, actually. I studied it when I was at school for some O-levels or A-levels or something. But it's when you learn music at that age, it's so much part of you. I could perform it all for you from memory. It's Die Winterreise. And it's particularly apt, I think, for this situation. It's about a great composer, very gregarious composer, Schubert, who was madly socialising at the end of his life, the last 2 years of his life, but at the same time grappling with being very alone and knowing that he was dying of syphilis and very confused, trying to put it down in music. This is Fischer Dieskau, who I grew up with as singing this piece to me, and I don't think anybody can sing it as well as this.
In die tiefsten Felsengründe lockte mich ein Irrlicht hin, wie ich einen Ausgang finde, liegt nicht mehr mir in dem Sinn, liegt nicht mehr mir in dem Sinn. Bin gewohnt, dass irregehen, es führt ja jeder Weg zum Ziel. Unsere Freuden, unsere Wehen, alles eines irrliches Spiel, alles eines irrliches Spiel.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing Irrlicht from Schubert's Winterreise, accompanied by Alfred Brendel. Which one of those eight records, Paul, if you could only take one of them, which one would it be?
Winterreise.
What about your book? You've got the Bible and you've got the complete works of Shakespeare.
I think I want a very large book, beautifully bound, with nothing in it. And I don't know whether I'd be able to write anything on them, but I couldn't possibly choose one way of thinking. And if I chose it now, it wouldn't be anything to do with what I felt like when I got there.
And what about your luxury?
This is probably two luxuries, but I would like one of those things in my life that's been on hold, like lots of things are, things you don't get back to. And one of them is a desire to learn to play the cello. But I also need a facsimile of Bach's cello suites to learn.
Oh, it's connected. I think you can take all of that.
Tortelier used to come and play them in Coventry Cathedral every year. We used to sit in a darkened cathedral looking at this one man sitting in a spotlight playing. It's an extraordinary, pure, wonderful music, but something that I've never got closer to than listening to. I want to learn how to do it.
Paul Daniel, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.